Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Sota Daf Mem Zayin. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a specially marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage, and then go to option 2. If you are already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief formatted introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins at the bottom line of Daf Mem Vov Omid Beis. We are in the middle of a discussion concerning Elisha and the Anshe Yericho, the story that we featured in our previous year involving Elisha's miracle of sweetening the otherwise bitter water supply of Yericho, and thereby, for the moment, causing a loss of income for those who were supplying the fresh water, the drinkable water. They became very upset. And they started to ridicule the prophet, and he was very displeased to say the least. And as a result, they ended up dying. And how did they die? They died through miraculous circumstances. The prophet, as he was walking, we saw in our previous year, he looked upon them and he cursed them in the name of God, and we pick up with that the bottom line. There's a description of what ensued. Vateitzeno shtayim dubim min hayar, two bears emerged from a forest, from the forest. Vativkano mehem arboim ushnei yelodim, and they the bears killed 42 of the young people who we are associating with those water providers. Rav Ushmuel, we're at the top of Mem Zayin Amud Aleph. Rav Ushmuel chad omar neis v'chad omar neis besoch neis. One opinion says there was one absolute miracle, and the other one says there were two miracles that took place. Man domar neis, the opinion that says there was one miracle being the out of the ordinary, the unnatural event. So if you hold like this opinion that says there was one miracle, yar have, a forest was there. It was a natural growing forest where the prophet and these detractors were located. Dubim lohavu. However, the forest had no bears in it. The miracle was that bears appeared, or bears were created for this purpose of retribution from the offenders. Mando amar neis besoch neis, according to the opinion that there was a double miracle, lo yar havu velo dubim havu. It was an area where there was no forest and there were no bears. The Gemara asks, well, within the context of a miracle, and let me just edit by way of a general statement or editorial statement, I know that we're dealing with the realm of miracles, and yet we find time and time again the effort, we'll say, on the part of the Chazal to see whether they could have managed with less miracle. And the reason for that is, in general, Jewish philosophy is such that miracles are not the maximum or the maximal level of behavior. The best in terms of this world is concerned, Olam Hazeh, is things taking place through, we'll say, non-miraculous intervention. This essentially is the will of God. He created nature, the laws of nature, and would prefer that that we go through life and even experience our salvation through natural means. And when miracles are needed, so it's some type of extreme circumstance, very pressing circumstance, or there's some type of, let's say, divine, we'll say, divine need, for lack of better expression, for the purpose of mankind to see the miracle. But otherwise, the Almighty would prefer doing things within the context of nature, and for man to discover the Almighty through nature. There are, in fact, statements in the Chazal that we find in a few places. One place stands out is Maseches Tainus, that it would actually be better for man not to benefit from that which is brought about miraculously. With that background in mind, we can continue in the Gemara. It asks, "Veleheve dubin velo leheve yar." Let there have been bears that appeared without the forest. What was the need for having the forest? The Gemara answers a very interesting answer, and it says, "De beisi." The bears would have been afraid to attack. And mind you, we're dealing once again within the realm of the miraculous, but even within the realm of the miraculous, as we said before, there's a tendency to try not to depart from nature, as at least as much as possible, to cling to the laws of nature. And a part of the laws of nature dictate that bears will not act in an offensive, attacking fashion unless they have a fallback position, namely a forest, a place of refuge, which would give them confidence. And that's what the Gemara is saying here, that deboisi means the bears would have been afraid to attack had they not had the forest background for them. And hence, the creation of the forest was necessary as well. Before we continue in the Gemara, we have a note, a topic heading on the side, which reads, under the Nosei heading, Tots Osov, the outcome, Shel Hakrovas Korbonus Al Yedei Bolok. In the Chumash, we find in Sefer Bamidbar, Bolok Melech Moav, the king of the Moabite people, was threatened by the Jewish people traveling through the Midbar, and he sought the services of the infamous Bilam, the prophet of the Gentiles, to curse the Jewish people. And as part of that story, we find Bolok offering sacrifices to the Almighty. And again, Bolok and Bilam were up to no good. They were up to attack the Jewish people, to defeat the Jewish people. And in the course of their schemes, we find Bolok offering sacrifices, hoping to arouse the Almighty for his cause. Omar Rabbi Chanina, Bishvil Arboim Ushnaim Korbonos Shikriv Bolok Melech Moav, because of the 42 sacrifices that this evil king offered, but he offered them heavenwards. He offered them not to idols, but to God. Hivku mi Yisrael Arboim Ushnaim Yolodim. There were 42 deaths, losses to the Jewish people in the aforementioned story involving Elisha. 42 Jews died. The Gemara asks a question: is that really the cause and effect with regard to Bolok and his sacrifices? Eini ve'omar Rav Yehuda Omar Rav. We do find a Maimur Chazal regarding the outcome of his sacrifices, but not the 42 young people that were killed. There's another outcome that we find, and Rabbi Yehuda Omar Rav tells us that Le'olam Yasek Odom B'Torah Mitzvus, a person should pursue the study of Torah and performance of mitzvahs V'Afal Pi Shelo Lishmo, even if his motivations are not totally pure. Shemitoch Shelo Lishmo Bo Lishmo. Through one studying Torah and performing mitzvahs, even if his purpose is to accrue honor and pride, and not for the pure sake of heavenly fulfillment of commands. Nevertheless, we say shemitoch shelo lishma bo lishma, through the non-pure motive, you will come eventually to fulfillment for pure motives. And what's the precedent for that? What's the basis for such an approach? Shebischar aboyim ushnaim korbonas shehikriv balok melech moyov, as a reward for the 42 sacrifices that the Balak, the king of Moab, offered, and his offering certainly was not with pure motivation. Nevertheless, zocha v'yotzisa mimenu rus, there came forth from him the great historical figure, Rus, the great grandmother of David. She, of course, had merits on her own right, in her own rights. And she, Yotzimenu Shlomo, there came forth from Rus, the great grandmother of King Solomon, Shekosuv Bey, regarding King Shlomo HaMelech, it says, Elef Oilos Ya'ale Shlomo, many sacrifices, a thousand sacrifices the king would offer up. V'yomar Rabbi Yossi ben Choni, Rus, Bitoi Shel Egloin, Benoi Shel Bola Kaisa. As far as genealogy is concerned, Rus was the daughter of Eglon, a Moabite king, who himself was a descendant from Balak. So, what's the point of this long question? The point is that the outcome of the sacrifices that Balak offered was the birth of Rus, who was a descendant from the Moabite people, tracing her ancestry back to Balak, and not the 42 young people that were killed. The Gemara answers, there's no question here per se. Tavoso miha leklola have. Balak's intention, his tavoso means his desire, was for cursing purposes. And that too came to fulfillment many years later in the time of Elisha. Vayomru anshi o'ir el Elisha hine no Moshe v'ir toiv kasher adoni ro'eh. The people of Yericho said to Elisha, behold, our community is very pleasant, as you can see. The Gemara asks, how can they describe their community as a pleasant place to live? V'chimeachar demayim ro'im v'eretz mishakeles elamato vasa. The Pasuk describes that region, that area, of having a bad water supply, and Eretz Mishakeles is a place in which people die, and they're praising it. Amar Rabbi Chanan Chain Mokom Al Yoshvav. Rabbi Chanan reveals a human truth, and that is that the grace of a place is upon its inhabitants, no matter. Without citing any specific well-known global metropolises, especially those in which there's a significant Jewish population, nevertheless, some of those places are, to the outsider, would be considered highly undesirable to live in, whether it's pollution, whether it's traffic jams that can result in people's transit time from work to an hour and out to an hour and a half in one direction every single day. And yet, when you speak to those people, they'll say, oh, our town, our city is the greatest place on earth. How can that be? Here it is. Chein Moko Malyoshev. Omar Rabbi Yochanan. Shloisha Cheinos Hein. There are three examples of grace whereby the one who perceives it finds beauty and desirability, whereas others, outsiders, wouldn't necessarily agree. And what are these three graces? Chein Mokom Al Yoshvav, the place that people dwell in for them is considered desirable. Chein Isha Al Baila, and here Rashi says Chein Ha'isha Tomid Al Baila. A husband will, of course, assuming some positive circumstances, a husband will always appreciate his wife, will feel, always find her very desirable, even if she is objectively ugly. Her husband finds her attractive. And number three, chein mekach al mekcho. A person purchases an article. The purchaser, appreciates it. Even though to outsiders they might think, what an odd item to have purchased. Oftentimes you can use examples in the realm of furniture. A person has a particular sofa that he puts in his living room, and it's just totally incongruous with the other furnishings and the decor of his domicile, and yet he purchased it, put it there. Must be that he likes it. People would walking in will raise an eyebrow. So be it. Chein mekach al mekho. The Gemara continues. Tonu Rabbonan, Shlosha Chaloyin Chola Elisha. There are three sicknesses or ailments that Elisha experienced. Echad Shegira Dubin Betinokos. One ailment was a type of punishment for his having acted in such a harsh fashion against those youth that were taunting him. It's true, they had it coming to them, but maybe he went a little bit too far. Rashi says, Echot Shigiro Dubin, Shigirom is to incite the bears to attack those young people. And Rashi says, Bavon Shigiro Dubin, it was viewed as a sin. It was, as I say, it was too harsh on his part. And what else? Another ailment, V'echot Shidochva L'Gechazi B'Shtei Yodayim. He also suffered a sickness because of his overbearing approach to his servant, Gehazi. Gehazi was not a positive character, and we're going to see as we go on in the Gemara a little more about him. But nevertheless, he pushed him away. He didn't accept him. After reprimanding Gehazi, we find he reprimanded him in a very harsh fashion. And the analogy used by the Gemara is he pushed him away with two hands. If you want to reprimand someone, and we'll see this too, as described later in the Gemara, you reprimand him in a moderated fashion, and that would be by pushing him away with one hand. Continuing the analogy, but two hands is too harsh, and he Elisha was punished for that. V'echad, and there was a final ailment, shemes bo, that he eventually died from. Shenemar, and the reference to three ailments is seen in this pasuk. V'elisha chola es cholyoi asher yomus bo, and Rashi describes chola. The word chola accounts for one, and es cholyo accounts for two, and asher yomuspo accounts for the third ailment. We continue in the Gemara. Tonu Rabbonon, on the side we have a topic heading. You'll notice the nosei / mivne heading. It should always be that if you need to reprimand, to castigate, so do so with your left hand. The left hand being, for the majority of the population, is the weaker hand. So when you want to castigate, when you push away, you do so in a weaker fashion. And when you want to draw someone near, you want to endear someone to yourself, do so with a greater strength, and let the right hand be that which draws near. The double underline marking that you will see as you scan down the Gemara highlights three, we'll say, examples of individuals who did not follow this dictum. And we highlight the lo kamo, number one. The first double underline involves Elisha. There's Elisha and Gehazi. Number two, it involves Yehoshua ben Prachya and his student. And I should say, just let me correct myself. There were two examples, not three, that we will feature in the Gemara. And those are the two double underlines that you see in the next number of lines. So now we look in the Gemara. Tana Rabbanan li'olam tehei smoil doicha v'yamin mekareves. One should always behave in such a way that the left pushes away and the right draws near. Loi ke Elisha shedachvoi l'geichazi b'shtei yodov. Not like Elisha and his behavior with regard to Gehazi, who pushed him away with two hands. V'lo ki Yeshua ben Prachya shedachvoi the echod mi talmidov b'shtei yodov, nor like the behavior of Yehoshua ben Prachya with regard to one of his students that he pushed away with two hands. We have a note on the side to look into a work called Chesronos HaShas. Chesronos HaShas is a work in which censored portions of the Talmud were, were accounted for. And in other words, that which had been censored out is recorded in this work called Chesronos HaShas. And in some Gemara editions, some contemporary editions of the Shas, you even find them printed into the text, sometimes in a different font, but whatever the case is, it's readily accessible. So in that particular work called Chesronos, meaning that which is missing from the Shas, there is a reading here that, as it says, Lo Yehoshua ben Prachya shedachvoi le'ha'noitzri. And the notzri is a reference to the founder of, or the one who is identified as the founder of Christianity. We're not going to get into this in-depth discussion concerning chronology, but it's interesting to note, at least, and I know that it's the subject of a great deal of research and scholarly work concerning the issue of dating. Just to put things in a certain historical perspective, if you make this assumption that the founder of Christianity was in fact a student of Yehoshua ben Prachya, bear in mind Yehoshua ben Prachya lived several generations before even Hillel and Shammai. And we know about Hillel. Hillel lived at a point in time that was approximately 100 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Some associate Hillel with the date of 30 before the Common Era. And then you roll back several generations before, and you get to the date for Yehoshua ben Prachya. And that's about all we're going to say on this topic. Something that, for those of you who want to research it further, so here you have an interesting starting point. The Notzri. The Notzri, some will say the Nazarene, and I'm sure most of the listeners know to whom we are referring. We'll get back to that story in a number of lines where you can see our double underlined highlight of Yehoshua ben Prachya appears. In the meantime, Elisha Maihi. What's this story involving Elisha? Dichtiv. So the Gemara, as we've said many times in Gemara markings, Daf Yomi Shurim, is presupposing a certain level of familiarity with the storyline of the Tanakh. So just a brief background here. There was a military official from one of the surrounding nations. His name was Naaman. He was a Sar Tzava. He was a military general of that particular nation, and he suffered from Tzaras. And to make the long story short, he was healed from his Tzaras through the advice that Elisha, the Jewish prophet, gave. And that involved his immersing in the Jordan River, and miraculously that helped Naaman. And Naaman felt a sense of gratitude and offered the the prophet, presents involving 8 different items, and the prophet refused to accept any remuneration for his advice, and there was this we call him the Elisha's servant. He was a person of let's say of desire, of maybe lust, and he said, "Oh, what a shame! All this wealth that my master could have achieved, and he's letting it all go." And he, Gehazi by name, after Naaman departed on his way, Gehazi caught up with him and said to the general Naaman, you were kind of like you owe us something. And he in the storyline, he took he requested 2 of the 8 gifts that the that had been offered to Elisha. Of course, as far as Elisha is concerned, that was a disaster. Here was a chance to sanctify the name of the Almighty. Here, a prophet of God Almighty helped this Gentile individual, general, and did so out of the norm, and accepted no remuneration. And here his Elisha's servant is coming and ruining everything by insisting on some payment. The Gemara, Dichtiv, Vayomer Naaman, Hoel Kach Kikorim. The military general that was healed offered payment. Uksiv vayomer elov. We should simply mention that this pasuk chav gimel, where vayomer Naaman hoel kach kikorim, was Naaman addressing Gehazi, as we mentioned earlier. Gehazi requesting some payment, so Naaman offers him, take these loaves, and in the pasuk you see also chalifos, clothing suits were also offered. That's pasuk chav gimel. As you go on in the storyline, Gehazi eventually comes back to Elisha, and Elisha asks him, where were you? And Gehazi says, I didn't go anywhere. And Elisha says as follows, Uksiv, Vayomer elav, lo libi holach, kasher hafach ish me'al merkavto likroscho. Did my heart not go with you? In other words, we're dealing here with a prophet who doesn't have to be physically present, and he knew very well that Gehazi had gone to Naaman, stopped him on his trip, and Gehazi took things from him. Ha'es lo kachas es ha'kesef v'lo kachto. Begodim, v'zeisim, ukromim, v'tzoin, ubokor, v'avodim, u'shvachas. This, and you took from him 8 things. The Gemara asks, why is the prophet charging Gehazi with having taken 8 gifts? Umi shakli kulehai, kesef u'begodim hu d'shokil. When you look at the pasuk, as we mentioned a moment ago, in pasuk of Gimel, you see that he didn't take 8 things. He took 2 things. He took the kikarim, the baked goods, and suits of clothing. Omar Rabbi Yitzchak, ba'oisu shah hoya Elisha oisek b'shmoyne shrotzim. When this event had taken place, Gehazi and Elisha had been studying the chapter in Maseches Shabbos called Shmoyne Shrotzim. What's significant for us is that the name of the chapter in Maseches Shabbos is called the 8 Shrotzim. Omar lo Rosha, so Gehazi, Elisha says to Gehazi, you wicked man, Higia Ace Litoil Schar Shmoine Shrotzim. Now is your time for getting the reward of your having studied that perek. And the affliction that Naaman suffered from, the tzaras, will cling unto you and your descendants forever. So that when the prophet was saying you took eight things, he didn't mean you took literally eight items. Rather, the items that you took, okay, you took those things, keep them, so to speak, as your reward for having studied the perek called Shmoina Shrutzim, the eight Shrutzim. But there's no such thing as a free lunch. That's your reward. Enjoy it. But you're going to suffer for having, say, foiled my plan in establishing a Kiddush Hashem, and you will now suffer with tzaras, you and your descendants. A pasuk that makes reference to four mitzrayim that you find in Sefer Melachim, Melachim Beis Perek Zayin, it says, V'arbo anoshim hoyu mitzrayim, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Ze Gehazi Ushloishes Bonov. Without getting into the whole story behind those four mitzrayim, all we need to say at this point is that curse did come to fruition. Gehazi and his three sons were all mitzrayim. Vayelech Elisha Damesek. Loma Holach. The pasuk says that Elisha went to Damesek. What did he go there for? Damascus is a city. Maybe it's associated with Damascus, but it's a city outside of Israel. And it says that Elisha went there. What did he go there for? Amar Rabbi Yochanan Shalach lahachziro legehazi b'tshuva v'lo chazar. He went to retrieve, to have Gehazi come back in repentance, but he didn't do so. Amar lo chazor b'cha. Elisha pleaded with Gehazi, return, repent. Omar lo, kach mekublani mimcha. Gehazi said, thusly I had received from you. Call me shechoto vehichti es harabim. Anyone who not only sinned, but caused others to sin, ein maspikin biyodo lasos tshuva. He's not afforded the opportunity to repent. My ovad, what did he do that the Gemara says he's guilty of machti es harabim, that he caused others to sin? So you'll see a list of possibilities, and the triangles highlight that. On the side under the Mivne heading, the triangle appears. These are Gimel, Deos, Bema, Gehazi, Hichti, es harabim. In what way did Gehazi cause the public to sin? So we continue now in the Gemara. Iko Yamri, some say Evan Sheves Tololoi Lechatos Yerovam Vemido Bein Shamayim Loretz. Again, Tanakh background would be very helpful. So we'll just briefly say, many years earlier there was a king called Yerovam. In English, I think he's referred to as Jeroboam. He was a contemporary of the son of Shlomo HaMelech. Again, just as for purposes of historical perspective, many generations, several generations earlier, this king Yerovam was threatened, so to speak, by Rehavam, and he caused the split in the Jewish nation. He, Yerovam, heading the northern part of Israel, comprised of 10 tribes. The southern region of Israel, the two tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, remained under the leadership of the descendants of Beis David, of the Davidic dynasty. During this time, when Yerovam ascended to power, didn't want the masses of Jews to practice the thrice annual pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So he set up golden calves, ironically, one at the, we'll say, the southern extent of his kingdom, and one in the northern part of his kingdom. The Gemara makes reference to those golden calves, which Yerovam suggested as an alternative place of worship to the Beis HaMikdash. Those calves are referred to by the word chatos. the sinful, we'll say the sinful calves. They were metallic, they were gold, and what Gehazi did is he set up some type of a magnetic apparatus that's referred to as Evan Shoeves, literally a drawing stone. But Rashi describes it as something that would appear to be a magnet that was capable of lifting these golden calves into the air. That created some type of, we'll say, imagery in the eyes of the masses. Maybe they didn't know how the calves were suspended. I don't know exactly what was in the minds of the masses when they saw this, but what they did see were these floating golden calves, and that would certainly increase their significance in the eyes of the masses, and hence he, Gehazi, for having done this, is called a machti esarabim, causing massive sinning. The Ika, the Amri, another version is shame chokak lo apumo. Again, with reference to the golden calves of Yerovam, not a magnet, but rather he knew the ineffable name of God, and he etched that out on the mouth of these golden calves. V'hoi soimeres, and the calf would say, the first two commandments of the Ten Commandments, Anochi, reference to Anochi Hashem Elokecha, and V'lo yeh lecha Elohim achirim, and you shall not have other God forms. So this golden calf then in effect was saying, I am your God. And naturally, that would be a major example of machti es harabim. V'o'iko di amri rabbonon docho mikameh. A third version is a practice of Gehazi where he did not allow the rabbis of the time, Rashi refers to the students of Elisha. Well, if we can make the assumption that Elisha was the Godol Hador, he was the major Torah luminary of his generation, so all the rest of the population would be considered his students, and this Gehazi limited the access of the Rabbonon to Elisha. Elisha, naturally, if Rabbonon had legal questions, halachic questions that needed resolution, they would have turned to Elisha, but he limited their access to him. How do we know that? Bichtiv. We know because it says in the scripture, it says in the Pasuk after Gehazi was removed from the scene, it says, Vayomru b'nei ha-Navim el Elisha, the student prophets, we'll say the scholars, they said to Elisha, Hine no hamokom asher nachnu yoshvim shom lefonecha tsar mimenu. They complained that there isn't enough room for all of us. So what can we infer? Michlal, it would then seem to be that the Adoidna until now, when Gehazi was still around, lo havedochik, it wasn't tight. In other words, there was enough room. Why? Because Gehazi was keeping the people away from Elisha. Once the Gehazi barrier was removed, so naturally many were now able to come in, and their reaction was that there isn't enough room for us for all of us over here. Yehoshua ben Prachya Maihi, what is the incident involving Yehoshua ben Prachya and the student? We already mentioned who that student was, according to the Chesronos Hashas. Again, here's historical perspective. There's a reference here to Yanai HaMelech. When this king, he was a king from the, we'll say, the Hasmonean dynasty, who was very unfavorable, to put it mildly, to the rabbis. And he is responsible for the murder of many rabbinical figures of his time. So when that was happening, Shimon ben Shetach, another luminary of that period, Amtinhu Achte, his sister, who happened to be the queen, she hid Shimon ben Shetach, which was her brother. So he escaped death through the good offices of his sister. Rabbi Shimon Prachya, he didn't have that that luxury. Ozal Orak Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim. He escaped to Alexandria in Mitzrayim. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya saved his life by running away. Ki havishalmo, when peace came, when the coast was clear, Sholach le Shimon ben Shetach. Shimon ben Shetach sent a message to Alexandria. Mini Yushalayim Irakudish Loch Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim. And it's a type of we'll say coded message. He says, from Jerusalem, the holy city, to Alexandria of Mitzrayim, Achosi Bali Shorui B'Sochech Vani Yosheves Shomeimo. My sister, my husband, is dwelling in you, meaning in Alexandria, and I am dwelling in desolateness. So what Shimon ben Shetach is saying, he's saying, you know, that he who is in Alexandria needs to come back here to Yerushalayim. Omar, so Yeshua ben Brachia, receiving this message, said, Shema mino, have le shama. It's a sign that things are peaceful. So he started on his journey back to Yerushalayim. Ki also, on his way, Iklo lahu ushpizo, he arrived at an inn. Kom kamayu biyakro shapir. The innkeeper, the woman was the innkeeper. As far as the storyline is concerned, it's a married woman that served Yoshua ben Prachya and his entourage. Biyakro shapir in yakro is honor, covet. In shapir means a lot of or a good amount of proper respect. Avdi le yakro tuva. And she served them with great respect. Yosef v'ka mishtabach, Yoshua ben Prachya was sitting there and he was praising Kama Noa Achsanya Zu. Now he said, "How Noa?" Here we run into a translation problem, or the double entendre of what Noa can mean. So Yoshua ben Prachya was saying, "Kama Noa." Noa is a word referring to pleasantness. It can also mean beautiful. So he was saying, he used the word na'ah. So how na'ah is this hostess? Omar le echot mitamidov. And echot mitamidov, we've dashed underline, that's a reference to, according to the Chesrinus Hashas, this is a reference to the founder of Christianity, the Notzri, the Nazarene. So he was a student, part of this entourage, said, Rebbe, hey, Neha, Trutos, her eyes are very round. They're ugly. In other words, trutas literally means they're spherical. They're round, as opposed to the eye's normal look would be, we'll say, almond shaped. So after hearing his Rebbe, Rabbi Shimon Prachya, saying Kama Noah Sanyazu, his reaction was, how can you describe her as Noah? Which that in his mind, in the Talmud's mind, how can you describe her as physically beautiful when she is ugly? Oh, my lay. So the Rebbe says, Rabbi Shimon Prachya says, Russia, you wicked one, bekachato isek. That's what you're involved with. That's what your mind is on physical beauty and gazing upon women and what have you. I said she's Noah means she's serving us very pleasantly, and your mind is preoccupied with physicality and a very undesirable behavior on the part of people. Certainly the Torah trains us to let's say have pure thoughts and not be preoccupied with this kind of thinking. And you see that's what was on this student's mind. Apik arba mea shipuri v'shamte. There is this term you find elsewhere in the Shas. It's a reference to putting someone into excommunication. The word shamte is excommunication, and the translation of this phrase is he took out, or he blew forth 400 shofars. The blowing of the shofar was a means of announcing, we'll say, excommunication. And for our purposes, the Rebbe censured this student. Kol yuma osu lekame velo kibble. Day after day, the student sought to return. He wanted to be accepted back into the fold. Yuma chad hava kori kriyashma. On one day, this happened again, where the student approached Rabbi Yeshua ben Brachia, and he, Rabbi Yeshua, was in the middle of reciting the Kriyashma. During Kriyashma, one is not allowed to engage in conversation. So while he was saying Kriyashma, Osala Kame, the student came again, like he's been doing in the past. Have a bedaite likbule, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Brachia, just on that moment, he said, you know, now is the time to take him back. So achvi lebiyod, he made some kind of hand motion. The hand motion, his intention was to basically say, wait a moment, I am interested in taking you back. However, it's a hand motion. It can also be understood in the opposite way. Sovar midchidochile, and the student thought that he was being pushed away once again. That was called the last straw. And Ozal Zokaf Leventa Palcha. He went ahead, he went and he erected a brick and started to worship the brick. There, the concept of a brick being used in worship, you actually find more on this in if I'm not mistaken, in Maseches Avodah Zarah. There's a discussion about that. For our purposes, though, it represents as we said, the final straw, whereby this student rebels and becomes an apostate. Amarle chazor b'cha. So Rabbi Shua ben Brach says, come back. Amarle kach mikublani mimcha. I have, just like we saw earlier, that anyone who sins and causes others to sin is not accepted back in repentance. And here we have a statement of what he was involved with. And again, if you look in the Chisreinus Hashas, it says here, Yeshu. Yeshu is an abbreviation of Yamach Shemoi Vizichro, a reference once again to the founder of Christianity. And what did he do? Kishef, he was involved with Kishuf. Kishuf is black magic. Black magic is a, we'll say, is a reality. It's and you may have heard stories of what that founder of Christianity was capable of doing, things that would appear in, let's say, in the supernatural. Very fine. You see here in the Talmud itself a reference to that, but it's not because of divine powers. It's because he had the knowledge of how to arouse the powers of the occult. Black magic. Vehesis, Vehidiach. Mesis and Mediach are terms that are used to describe those who cause others to rebel and become apostates. Vehechti es Yisrael, caused the masses to sin. And that's quite an apt description of that individual. Again, the issue of chronology, history, and all that entails is something that one might want to research further. But from our perspective, assuming, of course, the censor took out and ought to be returned, you can see what is being described. Tanya, Rabbi Shimon ben Elozer Omer, Yetzer Tinok v'Isha. When it comes to the Yetzer is the Yetzara, the evil inclination. Tinok, children, Isha, women, women, wives of individuals, when one needs to, we'll say, suppress, when one needs to reprimand, when one needs to chastise, te smoldoche v'yamin mikareves, do so, but in a moderated fashion. As we've said a few times today already, let the left push away, the weaker hand push away, and when it comes to drawing near and endearment, let the right draw near. Yetzer, the evil inclination, that is the, more specifically, it's a reference to the desire, man's desire for intimacy with women. So intimacy with women in an unbridled fashion is, of course, quite forbidden. Intimacy is allowed in the context of marriage. Now, if a person, let us say, tries to suppress his yetzer, it's quite possible that a person can do so in such a strong fashion that he will, let's say, it's like, as they might call it, mind over matter, or psychologically speaking, can impose upon himself a total disdain for intimacy, a sense of repulsion from it. Ah, what have we gained with that? There will be no procreation. The first and one of the major mitzvahs of the Torah is to engage in procreation. So that here the advice is that, if, yes, it's true, one must suppress his desire for intimacy, but not totally. And that's what we mean by the let the smoil be doche. Leave a little room for desire, for at least that will be manifest with, you'll be able to actualize that with one's own wife. Tinok, a child, the youth, and the youth, time immemorial, have been very sensitive. And if you chastise a youth too intensely, the fear is he'll run away and rebel. And certainly as this recording is being made, the stories abound with regard to that problem. And you can see it's not something that's unique to this particular time in history, but it goes back all the way back. Isha, likewise with a woman, with one's wife, if a person suppresses her, pushes her away, chastises her too intensely, she might walk out, so to speak, while still married, and find herself with other men. And Rashi says, "Teitzei l'tar b'sro," and can actually rebel and throw away all that which is dear and holy to us. The Mishnah. We continue with the general topic of the perek, the eglo arufa, the situation of finding a murder victim, and the Mishnah says, "Nimtza ha-horeg." The murderer was found. At what point in time was he found? Ad shelo nerfa ha'egla. If prior to the breaking of the neck of the designated calf that was designated for atonement purposes, while we were not knowledgeable of who the murderer was, so teitzei v'tir be'eder, well, we don't need the calf anymore. And therefore, it's set free to graze in the herd. Mishener fo hegla, if the murderer, the actual murderer was found, was discovered after the egla rufa ceremony took place, and the calf's neck was broken, tikover b'mekomo, it shall be buried in its place. Shal sofek bosa mitchilasa, it was brought because of doubtful the situation of doubt. Kipro spake of Ahochala. It atoned for that situation, the situation of doubt, and it's finished. So it's done what it's supposed to accomplish, and it's forbidden to benefit from it, so it's buried in its place. Nerfo egla v'achar kach nimtso ha-horeg hazeh harezeh yo-horeg. If the ceremony took place, in other words, the calf's neck was broken, and then they found the murderer must be punished. He is to be executed. There is a capital punishment for murder. The Mishnah goes on with circumstances whereby witnesses seem to contradict one another. Who do we follow? And we should point out before continuing in the Mishnah that the Torah describes the Egla Rufa as being a ceremony because of Lo Noda, meaning we don't know who committed the murder. The Pasuk in Devarim Perek Chof Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, which we've included on the side, which it opens the topic of Egla Rufa, says ki motze chol ba'adama asher Hashem lekecha noisein lechol rishta noifil basode lo noda mihiko. And we emphasize here lo noda mihiko. When you don't know who committed the murderer, then the process of Egla Rufa sets in. When we speak about not knowing, let's see how do we evaluate the following cases. Eid echad oimer ro'isi es ha'horeg. The eid echad oimer lo ro'isa. One witness says, I saw the murderer. Meaning, I saw the murder. And another witness says, you did not. Isha omeres ro'isi v'isha omeres lo ro'is. A woman says, I saw the murder. And the other woman says, I did not. That you did not. Hoyu orphan. In other words, in these two examples, we would say that the testimony cancels each other out, so you're left with zero testimony. Zero testimony means we don't know. And therefore, hoyu orphan, there would be the Egla Rufa ceremony. Eid echad omer ro'isi ushnayim oimrim lo ro'isa. One witness says, I saw the murderer, and two say, you did not. Hoyu orphan. The two will cancel the one. And if the one was saying, I saw the murderer commit the murder, and the two say, you did not, so he didn't see it as far as we're concerned. Didn't see it, that means we don't know. We don't know who the murderer is. Therefore, there would be a rifa. Shnayim oimrim ro'inu v'echod oimer lohen lo ro'isem. Two say, we saw the murder take place. And one says to them, you didn't see it. Lo hoyu orphan. What the one guy says is of no value because he's going up against two. And therefore, the two saying, we saw the murder take place, and therefore we know who the murder, we saw the murderer. Therefore, there is no Egla Arufa, because as we said before, the Pasuk says, Lo Noda Miiko, and that's not the case here. We have a double underlining scheme, which is going to highlight what we see on the side of the Gemara, the Nosei Mivneh heading, which reads, where you see the double underline featured, Ribui Roitzchim, the increase of murders. This is Mishnah, and you'll see this theme continues till the end of the Masichta, meaning the theme being as time goes on, things were getting worse and worse. In this particular instance, we're referring to increase of murder. Ribui Roitzchim Garma Lebitul Egla Rufa. The increase of murder resulted in no more Egla Arufa. Because many murders were taking place, we'll see, achieved the ability to identify who was committing the murders, or who the likely murderer was, and therefore, if we know who the murderer was, therefore, no Egla Rufa. And the Mishnah also makes reference to, Ribu Haminaafim, increased immorality, Gormo Lebitul Me Sota. The Sota waters, of which we've learned so much earlier in the Masichta, would no longer be effective. And we'll see why that is. Now the Gemara, the Mishnah, continues. Mishirabu Harotz Chonin, when murders were on the increase, when they increased, many murders were taking place. Botleg La Rufa. The Egla Rufa ceremony was deemed to be no longer to be practiced. Rashi says, Rashi occupies both columns, so that we're looking in the we'll call the outside column, or the column that would ordinarily have the Tosfos in it. Bot lo egla arufa, sharei makirin bohen mi horogil bohen larog. The people knew who was most likely to be the murderer. So it can't be described as what the Pasuk says, lo noda mihiko. Mishaba, the Mishnah goes on to say, Mishaba Eliezer ben Dinoi, Uschino ben Prisha Hoya Nikra, Chosru Lekroisoi ben Horatzchon. When Eliezer, this guy was apparently a big-time murderer, and when he came on the scene, he had been called Tchino ben Prisha. That's the name that the public referred to him as. They eventually called him Ben Horatzchon. There's a more on this, what this represents, if you look in the Marsha commentary. But let's continue in the Mishnah. Misherabu haminafim pasku mayim hamayim hamorim. The mayim hamorim, the bitter waters, that's the sota waters used for checking out a suspected a wife of immoral behavior. The Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai hifsikon. He is the one that said no more. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived, as you can see from the Mishnah, and as we know from many other sources, he lived at the time of the Beis Hamikdash, the end of the Second Temple period. And he is associated with the one who stopped the waters. There's quite a bit of discussion that one might get involved with here. Did he actually achieve high enough office at the time of the Beis Hamikdash to issue rulings? For those who are familiar with those other Gemaras, we're just trying to whet your appetite to look into this topic a little further. But the Mishnah credits Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai as being associated with the one who stopped the whole sota process, the drink, the Beis Hamikdash ceremony with the water in his time. Shenemar, the pasuk says, Lo efkoid al benoy sechem ki sizneno vi al kaloy sechem ki sinoafno ki heim v'chulei. The Rashi says Lo efkoid al niuf nisho sechem levodkom. The Almighty, and this is the prophet saying that a time will come that I, meaning the Almighty, will stop. Providing, we'll say, this checking out service that is represented by the Mesota, and why am I not going to help in checking out anymore, in revealing transgressions? Why? Because al b'nosechem ki sizneno, because it's a society where there's a lot of znus. V'yod kihem im im hazonos yifredu heim atzmam noafim kepreidim halolo. The pasuk uses the word yifredu. It's an analogous term referring to mules that are described as licentious creatures that engage in niuf, and niuf meaning immorality. And what Rashi is revealing to us is that the men folk themselves were guilty of a great amount of immoral behavior. Unbridled sexual behavior, and that situation causes the mei sota from not reacting. Mishemes Yosi ben Yoezer ish tzreda v'Yosi ben Yoichanan ish Yushalayim. When these men died, Botlu Hashkolos. We're talking about a period of time in the latter part of the second Beis Hamikdash. When they died, Botlu Hashkolos. That was the end of the Eshkolos. Shenemar Ein Eshkol Lechol B'chora Osa Nafshi. We look in the Rashi. What does Eshkolos mean? So Rashi says Meforish b'Gemara that the word Eshkolos is Shehakol Bohen, or we'll see the term Ish Shehakol Bo. What does that mean? A man that contained everything. Ad Yemehen, until their time, Lo Hoya Machloikis B'Chachme Yisrael. There was no there was no disagreement that remained amongst the sages of Israel. Kulan hayu omrim dvorim kinesinosan lemoishim isinai. When the Torah was passed down from generation to generation, it was of course before the Torah was written down in the form of Mishnayos and the Gemara. We're dealing with the oral Torah, the oral tradition. The oral tradition was passed down from the time of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, generation after generation, without any lasting arguments. If there was any matter that needed debate, so they would debate, they would vote and come to a conclusion, and things were very, very clear. V'hein horishonim shenechleku b'smichas korbonis b'yom tov k'namim m'chagigav v'hoya machlokes rishon shebisrael b'divrei Torah. When it was in their time that the first, say, lasting machlokis, where the controversy wasn't resolved, that started in their generation, and Rashi points out it involved the issue of the placing of hands on a sacrifice on a holiday. One is that allowed as part of the sacrificial process or not? The topic is discussed at greater length in Maseches Chagiga. We continue in our Mishnah. Yoichanan Kohen Gadol Hevir Hoidoas Hamaiser. When a person finished his tithing, if he did it properly, so in the fourth and seventh years of the sabbatical cycle, in other words, after 3 years had gone by, that brings you into the fourth year, around the holiday of Pesach, and in the Shemitah year, there would be a what's called Vidui Maisers, where people would announce, reciting from Psukim in the Torah, that they tithed their tithes according to the Torah law. In the time of Yochanan Kohen Gadol, he stopped that. We'll of course have to see why. Rashi says, "Heviro daras ha'maiser shelo yu misvadin biarti hakodesh v'chulev more meforish taima." The Rashi is referring to the psukim that we alluded to, and the reason for this will appear in the Gemara. Why he stopped it. Afu bitel, the Mishnah goes on at the end of the Omid, says Afu bitel es hama'urin ve'es ha'noikvin. He also stopped this process of the urin and the noikvin. We'll see that explained in the Gemara. Ad yomov hoyapatish makeb yushalayim of yomov ein tzorach lishol al hadmai. Until his days, we're at the top of Omid Beis, until his time, the hammer could be heard in Jerusalem. Now, what is that a reference to? Rashi explains. Let's read the Rashi together at the top. Ad yom of hoya patish maki b'shalim beveis hanapochim b'cholu shemoyed lasos melocha melechas dover oved shemuteres b'moyed. On Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of a holiday, technically speaking, creative activity, productive activity, some people use the term work, is forbidden. It's a holiday. However, they're called Chol HaMoed. There's an element of non-sanctity to those days. It's not, those intermediate days of the holiday are not the same as the beginning and the end of the holiday. And what is the major difference? And that is that there's leniency for that kind of work that, if not done, would cause the owner a financial loss. So there could be the types of work that would involve the activities of a blacksmith, which is a profession, an art, a craft that employs the use of a hammer that is bangs and creates a lot of noise, a clanging noise, that as a result of if he would not do that work, he would suffer a financial loss. We allow it, by letter of law, would be allowed to be done during Chol HaMoed. However, he, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, stopped it. He, even though it's a Dover HaAved, even though by letter of the law he would be allowed to do it, he stopped it because the noise was so audible at distances, and not everyone knew that what was being done was because of it being a Dover HaAved, and they, people would come to the erroneous conclusion that Malacha in general is allowed during the intermediate days. So he imposed this restriction. Let's continue in the with the next Rashi. Kol Yomov Lo Hutzruch Odom Lishol Chaver Al Admai. Rashi says Im Meusar Im Lav. This has to do with tithing once again. And in his time, there was no longer any need to ask one to ask his friend whether or not the tithing was done. Until that time, you had people that were ignoramuses. They were called amaratzim. They were not diligent in their tithing practices. So if a person who was, generally speaking, was careful, was knowledgeable, would buy produce from an amaratz, and I wanted to eat by this customer, I would ask him, you know, you bought from the Amoritz, did you tithe the tithes that that are necessary when it comes to stuff purchased from Amoritz? We suspect might not have tithed properly. So people would question, would ask one another, did you do the tithing that the original farmer might not have done? But in his day, he made it a rule that any stuff you buy from an Amoritz, you automatically have to tithe. If that then became the rule, others wouldn't have to add. One would not have to ask his friend, did you do the tithing? Being that it was an established rule that anyone who purchases from Amoratzim have to tithe. The Gemara, Tanu Rabbanan, Minayim Shimnerfo Eglovach Nimso Horeg. From where do we know that if the calf's neck was broken and then the murderer was found, She'ein poteris oso, the breaking of the neck of the calf doesn't exempt the murderer. Talmud Lomar, the pasuk says, "Ulorets lo yechupar ladam asher shupach bo ki'im bedam shofcho." The land will not be atoned for because of the spilled blood, other than through the one who spilled the blood. So that makes it very clear that the total atonement cannot be achieved unless the murderer himself is punished, is brought to justice, and is executed. And that having been said, even though the Eglah Arufa ceremony had been done prior to our discovering who the murderer was, that would not have solved, or that wouldn't have eliminated the need for the final capital punishment needed for the murderer when discovered. Eid Echodome Roisi Esahoreg V'chulei. And here the Gemara is referring to the section of the Mishnah dealing with the contradiction in testimony. Before we continue in the Gemara, we have a topic heading which reads Ne'emonus Eid Echod Be'eglo Arufa Lomar Roisi Esarotzeach. The Gemara will be looking into what's the source for the idea that a single witness is believed when he says, "I saw the murderer." In general, for testimony to be binding, you need to have two witnesses. And this discussion actually is a throwback to what we saw at the very beginning of our Masicht on Daf Beis, where in the realm of testimony concerning the suspicious woman suspected of immorality, we know that after a man had warned his wife, and then there's evidence that she had been in seclusion with another man, and a single witness eventually comes along and says, "I saw the actual act of intimacy," there is no further need for the May Sota. The Sota process stops. We believe the witness that the immorality took place. The whole purpose of the May Sota was to check out, was to reveal what for us is a state of doubt. But the testimony of one witness in the case of the Isha Sota, he is believed, which again is a departure from the norm when it comes to the rules of testimony. Same thing over here with regard to the Eglo Arufa. The testimony of a singular witness saying that I saw the murderer is enough to stop the process. Our Mishnah spoke about one witness saying I saw the murderer and one witness contradicting him, and we said in a case like that we go ahead with the Eglo Arufa because it's considered still lo noda, not known who the murderer was, not knowing who the murderer was. The Gemara points out Taimo de Makrishle. The reason that we continue with the Arufa is because you have one witness saying lo roi, so you did not see the murder. Ha-lo makrishle. If you didn't have a contradicting witness, all you had was one fellow saying, I saw the murder take place. Eid echad mehemon. That singular witness would be believed. Minohane mili. What is the source for that? That one witness is believed. Again, that's a departure from standard laws of testimony that require a minimum of two witnesses. Detanu rabbanan. Lo noda mi hiko. We referred to this pasuk earlier from Dvarim, Perek Chof Aleph, pasuk Aleph. Lo noda mi hiko. The Egla Rufa process takes place because we don't know who murdered. Ha noda mi hiko. If it is known who murdered, afilu echad besof olam. Even if the witness is somewhere out there in the world, lo hoyu orphan. Because if someone out there knows, we can't describe the situation as lo noda mihiko. It's not known. Someone does know. Rabbi Akiva Omer, minayin l'Sanhedrin shero echad shehorag es hanefesh ve'ein makirin oisoi shelo hoyu orphan. From where do we know that if the high court saw someone commit a murder, and they don't know who the murderer is, there would be no Eglo Arufa. Talmud Lomar v'einenu lo ra'u. The sages in the Eglo Arufa story have to proclaim, we did not see v'halo ra'u. But if the Sanhedrin saw, they saw. So it doesn't conform. That scenario doesn't conform to the rules of Eglo Arufa. The Gemara raises a question. Notice it's a long question. And it starts Hashto di Amris Eid Echod Mehemon. Now that you're telling me that one witness is believed when he says Roisi Esahorek, I saw it. Now what did we see in the Mishnah? If one witness says I saw it, I saw the murder, and another witness contradicts, they cancel each other out, and there is Egla Rufa. That's hard to understand. When you're telling me that the Torah grants believability to one witness when he says, I saw the murder, idoch chad hechi motzi makrishle. How can that one other witness come in and say, and contradict him and say, you did not see it? And then, as a result, we would go ahead with the Eglo Arufa ceremony. For Amar Ula, is it not so that Ula teaches, Kol Mokom, Shehemino Torah Eid Echad, Harei Kan Shnayim, where the Torah grants believability to one witness. Where do we find that? Well, we find it over here. We found it by the case of the Sota as well. There are cases that the Torah gives believability to one witness. He has the strength of two. The Ein Dvarav Shel Echad B'Mokam Shnayim, there's no room then anymore for the words of one witness who comes to contradict. One is nothing in the face of two. And yet in our Mishnah, we said, well, the one who says, I saw the murder, is canceled by the one who says, you did not. How can that be? Amar loch Ula. So Ula says, Tani lo hoyu orphan. In that very case of one witness saying, I saw the murder, and the other one saying, you did not, there would be no arifa. So he's changing the language or the ruling of the Mishnah. V'cheinom Rabbi Yisrael, Tani lo hoyu orphan. And Rabbi Yisrael says also, he agrees with the approach taken by Ula. You've got to change the text of the Mishnah by adding one word, lo, meaning they would not do arifa, because of what we said, that the one witness who says, I saw the murder take place, and as I know who the murderer is, is then reason enough to stop the egla arufa process. Rabbi Chia omar tini hoyu orphan. Rabbi Chia, though, he says, no, you keep the Mishnah as it is. Rabbi Chia kashya d'ula, but according to Rabbi Chia, is not the issue raised by Ula a problem? How can you say they would do arifa when the Torah gives believability to the one witness who says, I saw the murderer and the murder take place? He has the strength of two. How can he be contradicted? Lo kashya. There's no difficulty for Rabbi Chia. Kan bevasachas, kan bozeh acharzeh. It all depends. If the contradicting witness who says you did not see the murder, if he comes in bevasachas together with, means on the heels of the first witness, so then the second witness cancels out the first witness. However, if it's bozeh acharzeh, if the first witness came in and said, I saw the murder take place, and the court accepted his testimony, and then later a second witness comes in contradicting him, his contradiction won't be accepted. And in a case like that, so in fact, we would say lo hoyu orphan. The Mishnah, according to Rabbi Chia, then is talking about a case where these two contradictory witnesses came to the court together. Tanan, Eid echor oimer ro'isi esahoreg, ushnaim oimrim lo ro'isa. Hoyu orphan. This section of Gemara is in fact basically word for word a repeat from the Gemara earlier in this Masechta. So much so that Rashi says, I've explained this entire sugya earlier in the Masechta. So I certainly hope that today is not your first time listening to our Maseches Sota Shiurim. And you will therefore benefit by having this as a section of review. What the Gemara does is he quotes what we just read, one section of the Mishnah, draws an inference from it, and then we'll quote a section of the Mishnah, drawing an inference from that, and we'll see where that leads us. So we read so far from the Mishnah that if one witness says, I saw the murder, and two witnesses say, you did not see it, so those two witnesses, they cancel the first witness, and therefore there would be, as far as we're concerned, no one having seen the murder, and therefore hoyu orphan. Let's infer, ha chad v'chad, had it been one against one, lo hoyu orphan. So if one witness says, I saw the murder, and the other witness says, you did not see it, we can infer from here there would be no arifa. In other words, we're accepting the testimony of the one who says, I saw the murder. Tiyufta the Rebbe Chia. This would seem to be then a refutation of Rebbe Chia's approach. Gemara responds, Ulatameich, according to you, are trying to attack Rebbe Chia from this, Eimo Seifa. Continue reading the Mishnah. Shnayim omrim ro'inu v'yed echor omer lo ro'isem. Two say, we saw the murder, and one says, you did not see it. Lo hoyu orphan. There would be no arifa. And now we can infer from that, ha chad v'chad. However, had it been one against one, ha yu orfen, they would have done the arifa. In other words, one saying, I saw the murder, and the other one saying, you did not see it. They would have canceled each other out, putting us back in a situation of lo noda, not of no knowledge, and therefore they would do arifa. That conforms to Reb Chiya. Ela masnisen kula bepsule edus ukederebi Nechemya. The Mishnah is not to be read with inferences, but it's rather to be read at face value, and it's teaching me the laws concerning, we'll say, the acceptance of testimony by people who in other areas of law would not be accepted as witnesses. That's what the term psule edus. Famous common example of psule edus would be women. Women are not accepted as witnesses in general for things that require testimony. They're called psule edus. The concept of psule edus, of someone who is disqualified from testimony, does not necessarily, and just as a statement for those we'll call sensitive ears of the political correctness or what have you, just be aware that Moshe and Aharon, the Moshe Rabbeinu and Aharon Kohen Gadol, could not serve as a pair of witnesses. They're called psule edus. They're brothers, they're relatives to one another. So what exactly is at the root of disqualification from edus? That's another topic. That's something that one has to research. But it's not a statement of, let's say, of any less quality of the individual, of a second rate. Any second ratedness associated with the individual. It's a gzeiras hakosuv. It's the Torah. It's God's will. So there are, though, situations where psule edus are accepted, and we have that at hand. Ucha de Rebbe Nechemya, and in accordance with his approach, the Omar kol mokom shemina Torah eid echad, wherever the Torah gives believability to a singular witness, halochacha rov deos. It becomes a topic where you follow the majority. The asu shtei noshim beish echad kishnei anoshim beish echad. In a case like that, two women against one man would be like two men against one man. Just like in a case of two witnesses, two male witnesses against one male witness, we will disregard what the singular man says. Likewise, two women who testify against one male, the one male will also be disregarded. And that's what our Mishnah is talking about. So that when you go back to the last two quotes before this, the last two Tanaic sources that we have, is the quotes from the Mishnah, you can have the first read Eid Echad Omer Roisi Esahore Gushnaim Omrim Lo Roisa. That would be one man says, I saw the murder. Two women saying, you did not see the murder. We listen to what the two women are saying, and therefore, as far as we're concerned, no murder, no knowledge of murderer is present. And Hoyu Orphan. And likewise with the Seifa, you have two women saying, we saw the murder, and one man saying to the women, you didn't see it. We don't listen to that one man. And we believe, we accept the two women, and therefore, no arifa. V'ika d'amri. We continue in the Gemara. Another version of Rabbi Nechemya is as follows. Kol hecha d'asa eid echad kosher meikara. If one acceptable witness comes at the outset, one man, one adult man comes at the beginning, afilu mea noshim ki echad damin. Even 100 women would be no stronger than a single voice. V'hocha b'may askinon. So that in a case like that, let's use an example. If one man came and said, I saw the murder, and 100 women would say, you did not see it, there would be no arifa. We would believe the one man who says, I saw the murder. However, the Hacha B'Mayaskinan, in the Mishnah where we saw that two overrule one, Kagon Da'asoi Isha Meikara, the first one to appear, the single witness to appear, was a woman who says, I saw the murder. And with this approach, we have to, let's say, re-present Rabbi Nechemiah thusly. Rabbi Nechemiah Oimer, Kol Mokom Shemino Torah Eid Echad, if you're in a topic where the Torah gives believability to a singular witness, as we mentioned before, the Sota topic or the Egva Rufa topic, Haloch Acha Rov Deos. You follow, if there's a contradiction in testimony, you follow the majority. V'yosu Shtei Noshim B'Sho'achas, two women against one woman, Kishnei Anoshim B'Ish Echad, be like two men against one man. The one wouldn't have a chance. Aval shtei noshim beish echad. However, if it's two women going up against one man, then ki palga upalga domi. It would have the same, say, strength as one against one. The Gemara asks, well, according to the approach taken by the Gemara, that our Mishnah represents psule edus, and hence we come to the conclusion you follow the numbers. Why do I need two examples of that? Vitarte psuli edus lomali. If you go back to the end of the narrow lines of the Gemara, we had a quote from the Mishnah, and then of the first wide lines, a second quote from the Mishnah. Those are two cases where we are illustrating the rules of psuli edus. But once you establish the rule that simply two overrule one, why do I need two examples of that? So mahu detema ki azlina bosa roiv deos l'chumra. If I had only one example, I would have thought that we'll follow the roiv deos, the majority opinion, when the result is one of stringency. Aval l'kula lo, but where the result would be a kula, a leniency, maybe then I won't follow the rov deos. Komash malon, we reveal here that under all circumstances, whether the result is a stringency or the result is a leniency, you follow the majority opinion, the majority testimony. Misherovu haroitzchim v'chulei. Tonu rabbonon. Misherovu haroitzchonim bot le'egla rufa. When murders increased, the Egla Rufa ceremony was canceled. The whole Egla Rufa is brought when we are in a state of true doubt. So what the Gemara explains is that when this Tanaic source says Misharavu Haratzchonim, it really means when Ratzchonim in public, when public murders became popular, so then everyone knew who the murderer was. So there's no more need for Egla Arufa. Misharavu Hanoafim V'chulei Tanu Rabbanan. The Pasuk says in the topic of Sota, V'nika Ha'ish Me'avon. And we darshan this, when the husband is free, is clean from sin, then if you have a righteous husband and he has a wife that he suspected of immorality, she can be brought to the Beis Hamikdash and the water will be effective in revealing the act, or if she's innocent, so nothing will happen. If the husband is not so righteous himself, he's not clean from sin, the wife of such a man will not be checked out by the Sota waters. The Oimer, the Pasuk says, lo, in addition, the Pasuk says, lo. We read and explained that pasuk before, and here the Gemara wants to know, my viomer, what do I need that additional pasuk for when we had the opening pasuk, v'nika ha'ish me'avon? So the Gemara explains, and it's in a, say, several stages, and that's why you have this double underlining marking to explain how, to what extent do we go when we say that when there's a society of sin, that the water will not be effective. V'chi tema avon didei in. You might say that from the pasuk of Anika ha'ishme avon, when the man is clean from sin, so the water will check, that the only concern is his own sinfulness. That meaning, if the husband himself is sinful, so then the water will not check out. But dibonei udivinase lo. If the man is righteous, but his children, he has a family, his sons, his daughters are immoral, so then the water will remain effective with regard to his wife. Toshma, that's not so. You can have a situation where the man himself, the husband himself, is righteous, but his children live immoral lifestyles. The pasuk says, "Lo efkod al beno sechem ki sizneno v'al kaloi sechem ki sino afno." That pasuk indicates that I, the Almighty, says, "I remove myself. I won't enable you to have the benefit of these sota waters if your sons." If your daughters and your sons live a life of immorality, v'chitema avon eishes ish in avon depnuyolo, you might say that okay, the waters are canceled from being effective if the nature of the sin is married women behaving immorally. Let's say one has a son, a daughter. Particularly a daughter, that she's a single woman, and she leads a loose lifestyle. That is not going to stop the waters from being effective. That the only concern would be a man whose family behaves immorally in the realm of Ashes Ish. Well, we have news. Ki heim im hazoinois yiforedu v'im hakadeshos yizabehu. The term zonos, harlotry, is most often associated with unmarried women behaving, having intimacy with all kinds of men. But yet, the very pasuk that we quoted, indicate, which started lo efko rabbeinu sechem, mentions ki heim im hazonos yiforedu. They behave, even the single women behaving immorality will stop the sota waters from being effective. The pasuk says, goes on to say, and we ask here, my ve'om lo yovin yilobet. What does that mean? Omar Rabbi Yelozer, Omar lem novi l'Israel. The novi, the prophet, addresses Israel. Im atem makpidim al atzmechem, if you are diligent with regard to yourselves, you're moral and chaste, so mayim boikim nishosechem, the waters will be effective in checking out your wives if they fall under suspicion. V'im lav, if you're not careful with yourselves, if you're loose and immoral yourselves, ein hamayim boikim nishosechem, the waters will not check out your wives. So the person cannot think to himself that, well, I'll do whatever I want, but with my wife, I'm gonna be strict and restrictive and supervising, etc., and so forth. Not at all. If a person has to be himself of moral upstanding in order for him to even think that his wife will be subject to the scrutiny of the water. We have, as you can see, a very long Tanaic source. On the side of the Gemara, we have a topic heading, and you'll also notice the Mivneh, the structural note, where we, let me just correct myself, we indicated earlier the structural note. The triangle, highlighting the term Misherabu. And we continue with that marking here. And our note says, the Nose says, Ribui tofaos agormos ivus hadin. See, many developments and behaviors that result in the contortion of justice. The Gemara. Misharabu Bale Hano Nisafsu Hadinim Veniskalkalu Hamaisim V'ein Noyach Ba'olam. With upon the increase of the Bale Hano, literally would mean the pleasure seekers. When pleasure seekers come about, pleasure seekers can also be associated with people that want things easy, aren't the type of people that are willing to let's say research things, extend themselves, to strain themselves to find the truth. So when you have that situation of Bali Hano on the increase, so justice becomes contorted and niskalkula maisim and the practices and the righteousness becomes distorted, and there's no noach is pleasantness in the world. This term, by the way, of Nisafsu Adinim V'Niskalkul HaMaisim, we've seen earlier, back on Daf Mem Aleph Omid Beis, in the context of Mishe Yorda Egroifa Shel Chanufa. And I recommend looking at the Rashi that describes these terms back there on Mem Aleph Omid Beis. Misheravu Roye Ponim Badin Botel Lo Soguru. The expression roe ponim might very well refer to judges who appear to favor one of the litigants over the other. When that happens, then people who come into a court case, with that there's botel means there's stopped being the concept of lo soguru. Lo soguru me'ish is a posuk which demands of judges not to be fearful of the litigants. Don't be fearful of anybody. And if you're having people, judges that play favorites, apparently the judge feels intimidated by one of the litigants. So you see that this posuk will no longer be fulfilled. And uposuk lo sokiru. Lo sokiru is a posuk which commands judges not to show favoritism. But if rovu roe ponim, so we're no longer fulfilling the pasuk of lo sakiru, not to play favorites. Uparku o shamayim v'nosaleim oil baser badam. With this, you have the shirking off of the yoke of heaven, and that being replaced with the yoke of men. The judge feels intimidated. He feels pressured by mankind. He doesn't have so man. Boss of Adam, man is above him, and not the Lord alone. Misharavu lochashe lechishos bedin, rabo haroin af b'Israel. What is meant by lochashe lechishos? So we look in Rashi. He says orche hadayonim umislachshim im hadayon luftoch lehem pesach b'schusu shel zeh ubechayvoso shel zeh. These are intermediaries that work on behalf of the litigants. And these people will go and literally they'll whisper in the ears of the judges why they should favor one over the other. There should not be intermediaries in court cases. Rather, the judges listen directly to the litigants' own arguments, and that's the way justice is to take place. So with these intermediaries intervening on behalf of one side or the other, so then Rabba Charon Af Bisrael, heavenly wrath is increased on the Jewish people, V'nistalka Shechina, and the divine presence departs. Mishum Shenemar, the Posuk says, and the Gyrus on the side suggests reading from the earlier part of the Posuk, Elohim Nitzov Badas El, Bekerev Elohim Yishpot. The Almighty is present when he is amongst judges. The suggestion here is that, well, if there are people other than the judges that are present, namely have these lochashe lechishos, so the Almighty is not present. And that's nistalko hashchina. Misheravu achrei bitzom libom holech. When there was an increase of those that follow the lust of their hearts, you have this contorted justice, Ravu Ha'imrim, you'll find the increase of those that say, Lara Tov, that which is evil is good. They praise the wicked, v'latov ra, and those that claim that that which is actually good say is no good. Here you can see there's a progression, and when there's an increase of those that praise the wicked and demean the righteous, the positive, ravu hoi hoi ba'olam. The term hoi is like we say the word woe, and you find in the prophet, in the Novi, you find this word on numerous occasions, and hence the reference made here. Misha ravu Moshe Harok, Ravu Hayahirim. Moshe Harok literally is people that draw their saliva. Rashi explains it's some type of behavior that's characteristic of the haughty. So when haughtiness increased, so there was the Ravu Hayahirim. Yahirim Yuhara is a word referring to the Balei Gaiva, those haughty individuals. So when you saw this practice, you can rest assured there were a lot of haughty people on the increase. When you have haughtiness is characterized by those who say, I know everything. I have nothing to learn from you. A Talmud, a student, is someone quite the opposite. He's coming to say, I don't know everything, I need to learn from you. So with the increase of the Yehirim, there's a decrease of Talmidim, of students. V'atorah chizeres al lomdeha. And the Torah is, so to speak, is seeking out who will only come to learn from me. The Torah, as its name suggests, is its instruction from Hora'ah, a source of instruction. If you have people that are overcome with the spirit of haughtiness, they don't turn to the Torah for instruction. They know everything. So the Torah, in a society like that, is seeking out those who will learn from it. Misharavu ha-yehirim, hischilu b'nois Yisrael linose lehirim. When the haughty increased, the Jewish daughters, the women of Israel, sought out to marry these kind of people. She'ein doreinu roe elo lifnim. Our generation only sees that which is which is viewable, the external. And you have people that carry themselves as if they're as if they know everything. They and inflated chests and whatever will limit all the possible examples that we could give. But nevertheless, that would serve to attract the women. The Gemara interrupts this Tanaic source, and as you can see, we have brackets here. The next two lines later, at the beginning of the line, the series continues. However, in the meantime, the Gemara asks on this very last point, since when is it so that women are attracted to the Yehirim, those people that have that puff themselves up? Aini, is that so? Vomamor, high minded miyaher, someone who is haughty, afilo inshibase lo mikbal. Even on inshibase means a member, literally the members of the house, but it's a term referring to even upon one's wife, he is not accepted. Shneimar gever yohir v'lo yinove. That's the pasuk, and it's darshan lo yinove means afilu b'neve shalom. Yinove means a dwelling. He won't be accepted. A gever yohir, a man who was proud in the negative sense, won't be accepted even in his own house, even by his own wife. So the Gemara explains, Meikara Kofsale, yeah, at the beginning, when the men are courting the women, and they're going on dates, and they're meeting one another, so they're attracted to these kind of people. However, when they get to live with them, Lesof Mitzilalayo, they become cheapened upon them. In other words, the women who are married to these haughty ones no longer have any respect for them. Misharavu matile mlai al bale batim. When there is an increase of matile mlai, so we have to explain what is that. Rashi says matile mlai hadayonim matile mlai. Mlai is pragmatia shalem, merchandise. Al bale batim. Judges, people of let's say rabbinic authority who sit in judgment. They're also people. They need a source of income. What's described here? They, judges, would have some, let's say, cash and buy merchandise. But they weren't going to be the ones to actually market their merchandise. What would they do? They would seek out members of the community to, as Rashi says, it goes on, hayoyde betiv schara, that were familiar with commerce. She yistakru hadayonim ayado. These yoyde betiv schara, these local merchants would market the items bought by the dayonim, and they would share in the profits, and the dayon would thereby make money. However, there's a problem here. The dayan, the rabbinic figure, who is now reliant upon these members of these local merchants to market their own merchandise. The Gemara goes on. Rabo hashochad v'atoyes mishpadu poska toivo. There was now increase for shochad, bribery. There's room for bribery, and in other words, the judge can actually, by having someone do be quite successful in marketing his own merchandise, that itself would represent a potential bribe in his eyes, and that results in contorted justice. Uposka toivo, and the good benefit will cease. When this was on the increase, people who would receive favors and be beholden to others for favors done to them, Ravu ish hayosher bi'einov yaseh. Then there would be people who, if you have judges that become beholden to the members of the community for favors done to them. So then those people who did the favors wouldn't feel any pressure to conform to the rule of law, and ish hayosher bein avyasa, people would do whatever they wanted to, whatever they want to do. Shvelim hugvahu, the lowly would rise. Vagvoyim, those who were on top, hushpalu, would be lowered. Umalchusa ozla v'navla, and the government will continue to decay. These are comments that are, to say the very least, very, very prophetic. When you have people in governmental positions, decision-making positions, judging positions of justice, and they're involved with all kinds of financial dealings that we've been describing at great length over here. So, of course, the honor given to the government, the seriousness in which or respect that people would grant their governmental officials, declines more and more and more. Umalchusa ozlo v'navlo. Misharabu tzorei ayin v'torfei teref. When miserliness, tzorei ayin, are people that are, as Rashi says, milahonu sachem b'mamonam, people that are unwilling to benefit others through their own financial capabilities. And torfei teref, Rashi says, gazlonim, thieves, umamse alev minayim, people who withhold their hearts from assisting the poor. So when this increases, rovu mamse alev, v'koypsi adayim milahalvos, when you have people of, I'll say, miserly nature, unwilling to help others, so you have people then withholding, clenching their hands, closed on their money, unwilling to loan others. Milahavas is to loan others. The avru amashe kosa b'torah, and are thereby violating that which the Torah says. He shomer l'cha pen v'chulei. The pasuk warns against those who refuse to extend loans. The Torah expects of us to assist others financially. So, but if the spirit of the day is one of miserliness, that inevitably is going to lead to a violation of this negative command from Dvarim Perek Tezvov. Misharabu Nitoyas Goron Umisakroi Sinayim. This is a reference to the topic of immorality and immodesty. Netuyas Goron and Mesakra Seinayim is a reference to women who walk in, let's say, in alluring fashion. And Mesakra Seinayim, you can see in the word Mesakros, the word mascara. In fact, it has to do with cosmetics, alluring looks. So if that's the society in which you find yourself, be aware, Ravu Mayim Hamorim Elo Sheposku. There'll be an increase for the need for the Sota waters, but they won't work anymore. Misha Ravu Mekabli Matonus Nismatu Hayomim V'Niskatsu Hashonim. When you find a society where people are happy to receive gifts, so the result of that is shortening of days and shortening of years, meaning people won't merit living to their full life expectancy. Dechtiv, the Pasuk says, V'soine matonos yichyeh. He who has a disdain for gifts and doesn't accept gifts will live. Misharavu zechuche halev, ravu machlekes b'Yisrael. When there's an increase of zechuche halev, Rashi explains, Zuchu Halev, She'ein Matinis Ozma Onznam Lishmo Yofim Mipirabam V'Soimchem Al Binosam L'Dakdek Shmuasam. These are people that don't listen too carefully to their teachers, to their Rabbonim, and they rather rely on their own intuition and their own knowledge to come to conclusions. So when you have that, so you have an increase of machloikas, of controversy in Israel. The source goes on to illustrate a situation like that. Mishiravu Tamidei Shamai V'Hillel Shelo Shimshu Kol Tzorchan Ravu Machloikis B'Yisrael. When there was an increase of the students of Shamai and Hillel that in fact did not study enough by their teachers, that resulted in disagreement and controversy in Israel. V'nasa Torah k'shtei Toros, and it almost appeared as if there were two Toros. And we know how difficult a situation that could be, which at times in history actually resulted in sections of Israel breaking off from the main trunk of the Jewish people. And then disappearing into the annals of history, no longer being part of the mainstream of Judaism. So this situation of Nasis Turek Shtei Toros is something that's a very threatening situation. Misharavu Mekablei Tzedakah Min Oivdei Kechavim, and when there was increase of accepting charity from the idol worshippers, from Gentiles, Hoyu Yisrael Lamalo Vehem Lamato, this is a euphemism. The translation is the Jews were up and the Goyim were down, but not so. It's, as we say, euphemism. When Jews become dependent on the Gentiles for charity, for support, so the Gentiles then gain the upper hand and the last say, and they're on top, and the Jewish people are down. Yisrael Lifnim Vehem Lochor, again, a euphemism, which the translation would be the Jews are in front and they're in back, but that's not what the intention is, it's the opposite. Mishemes Yosi Ben Yoezer V'chulei, the Mishnah mentioned Botlu HaEshkoilos, my Eshkoilos, what is meant by that term? Omar of Yehuda, Omar Shmuel, Ish Shakol Bo, a person in whom everything is found. We explained this earlier, and it's a reference to people who did not have any, let's say, doubts. There was no machlokas, there was no controversy until his time. Up till his time, the people who studied Torah studied with the same, let's say, level of clarity as the Torah was given from Moshe at Har Sinai. But at that point in time, machlokas went on the increase. Yochanan Kohen Gadol, Hevir Hoidoyas HaMeiser. Yochanan Kohen Gadol stopped the Meiser declaration, and we mentioned this earlier. That has to do with after 3 years and the seventh year of the sabbatical cycle, people would announce through reciting psukim in the Torah that they fulfilled all the laws of tithing properly. my time, why in his time did they stop the Hoidoyas Meiser? Omer Yossi Bar Chanina, Lefishein Noisen, also Ketikuno. Because in his time, they weren't giving the Meiser as the Torah intends. The Torah says that Meiser, specifically Meiser Rishon, is given to the Levim. It's one tenth of a person's produce each year of the six years of the 7 year sabbatical cycle. Seventh year being, as its name, a sabbatical year. No, there's no tithing then. But during the 6 years of agricultural produce, one tenth of one's produce is given. From the Torah standpoint, it's supposed to be given to the Levi. We continue at the top of Daf Mem Ches, Ve'anan Koyavinon L'Koyhanim. And we give the Meiser Rishon to the Koyhanim. The reason for that is there was a knas, a fine imposed on Levim in the time of Ezra that they no longer deserved receiving the Meiser Rishon tithe. The Gemara asks, Velodi Ashar Maisros. Granted, we don't give the Maiser Rishon anymore as the Torah intended, but the other tithes we give properly. For example, Maiser Sheni, that's the tithe, 10% of one's produce. First, second, fourth, and fifth years, one takes those fruits to Jerusalem and eats them there. On the third and sixth year, we tithe the Maiser Oni and give that to the poor. So why don't we at least announce our fulfillment of the other tithes? Omar Reish Lokish, Kol Bayis She'ein Misvada Al Maiser Rishon, any household that is incapable, and no one is capable anymore of announcing his fulfillment of the Maiser Rishon Levi tithe, Shuv Ein Misvada Al Shar Maisers. He no longer is entitled to be misvade, to announce his fulfillment of the other tithes. My taima, why is that? What's so significant about the Maiser Rishon that everything else is dependent on that? Omer Abaye, Hoyu uposach boy hakosuv trilo. Since it was the first of the tithes to be mentioned in the section of the Torah dealing with tithes, so it's if the first one falls, so to speak, everything falls by the wayside as well. And no more, therefore no hoidoyas meiser regarding the other tithes. The Gemara asks, Michlal, and this is the beginning of a long question, Michlal da fushe havu mafrushi? What we've said till now is that the meiser shein, meiser rishon levi tithe, it was tithe, but it wasn't given to the Levium. We explained it was given to the Kohanim as a result of a fine imposed by Ezra at the beginning of the Second Temple period. You're implying, though, that they did separate the Maiser Rishon tithe. Ah, v'ha tanya, but we have a Tanaic source that comprises the bulk of our long question. What do you mean that they tithe the Maiser Rishon tithe? We have evidence to the contrary. It says, Af hu, it's Yochanan Kohen Gadol, Bitel es Avidui, he canceled the recitation of the Vidui Maisers, the Gozar al Hademai, and he ruled concerning Demai, that produce bought from the ignorant must be tithed. We're making the assumption that those who are Amoratsim didn't take care of the tithing. Lafi Sheshalach B'chol Gvul Yisrael, where Yochanan Kohen Gadol had sent scouts, emissaries, representatives amongst the within the boundaries of Israel, the Rosh Shein Mafrishin El Truma Gadol B'Vad. He found that the only tithe that people were diligent in tithing was the Truma Gadol. That's the tithe that people give to the Kohanim. The amount for Truma Gadola from the Torah standpoint is any amount, even a minuscule amount. Rabbinically, it's approximately, we'll say 2% of one's produce. U'maiser rishon u'maiser sheni mitzosin ma'asrin u'mitzosin ein ma'asrin. Now, notice we've dashed underline the terms maiser rishon and mitzosin ein ma'asrin. With regard to the Levi tithe and the maiser sheni, the Jerusalem oriented tithe, some tithe, some didn't tithe at all. And it's really from here that we have our question, because before this we suggested that, oh, everyone was tithing the Maiser Rishon tithe, they just weren't doing it the Torah expected way. Here it seems they weren't tithing at all. Omar Lohem, Yochanan Golo said to the population, Bonai, Bo'u V'Omar Lohem, let me come and let me tell you something. Kashem Shetruma Gedola, Yeshba Avoin Misa, just like Truma Gedola, if it's not tithed, if one eats untithed produce with Truma Gedola, the latent Truma Gedola in it, he is guilty of death at the hands of heaven. Well, kach Trumas Meiser v'tevel yeshwen avon misa. So too, Trumas Meiser is 1/10 of the Levi tithe. When a Levi receives his 10%, that Levi has to turn around and give 10% of what he received to a Kohen. That has the same status as Truma. So Trumas Meiser and Tevel. Tevel is a term referring to untithed produce. There are other tithes, like the Meiser Oni tithe, eating untithed produce. Yesh Bohen Avon Misa. If these things aren't taken care of, it results in death at the hands of heaven. So that these people who were concerned with the Truma Gedola alone were doing so out of ignorance, thinking that only the Truma Gedola represents a life threat to them. Omad v'hiskin lohem, Yochanan Kohen Gadol arose and imposed the following. Halokech peres me'amoretz, a person who buys produce from an ignoramus, mafrish man meiser rishon u'meiser sheni, you have to tithe the meiser rishon tithe and the meiser sheni tithe. Meiser rishon mafrishimena trumas meiser, and once you set aside the meiser rishon tithe, from that you have to then separate 1/10 called trumas meiser v'noisna l'koyin, that 10% of 10%, that's the meiser of the trumas meiser, you give that to a kohen. U'meiser sheni oyel v'chlu b'yushalayim, and you will take the meiser sheni tithe from that which you set aside from the produce that you bought from the Amorites and take it and eat it in Jerusalem. Meiser rishon u'meiser oni, with regard to the meiser, the basic meiser rishon that you set aside, and from it you took 10% to give to the kohen, but the rest, the other 9/10, which is here to refer to as the meiser rishon and the meiser oni, that's the tithe that would be taken on the third and sixth years of the sabbatical cycle from produce that you bought from the Amoretz, hamotzi mechavero olav araya, that you can keep for yourself. If someone can prove that the Amoretz from whom you bought the produce didn't tithe, then you have to part with it. But as long as that hasn't been proven, Meiser Rishon and Meiser Oni are matters of purely financial concern. They're called mamon. They don't have in them the same level of chumrah, of seriousness, as truma or trumas meiser, that engender not only the fact that it has a mamon side to it, that it belongs to the kohanim, but if it's eaten by a non-kohen, it results in misa bidei shamayim. It's a serious, we'll say, spiritual factor as well. So when it comes to the meiser rishon and meiser oni, from that you tithe from produce that you bought from an Amoretz, and we didn't explain too much earlier with regard to the Amoratzim, we saw above some tithe, some didn't, it was a matter of doubt. When you have a matter of doubt concerning financial issues, we say hamotzi mechavero, someone who is trying to extract from his friend, it's upon him, the one who tries to take away, to bring the proof. At this point, though, we've come to the end of our long question. Above, we suggested that he was mevatel, that Yochanan Kohen Gadol was mevatel hodoyas meiser, because the meiser rishon was tithed, but given to kohanim instead of levim. In this source, we see that there were those that weren't tithing it at all. The Gemara answers, Tarti tikein. There are actually two stages of ruling, of edicts. Bitul vidui de chaverim, he was mevatel the vidui maestris of chaverim. Chaverim are say a term referring to people who were diligent, as opposed to amoratsim, the ignorant. Chaverim are people that are careful. So, with regard to hodoyas meiser on the part of chaverim, people who certainly tithed, they can't say the hodoyas meiser because they're giving their meiser rishon to kohanim and not levim. A second edict, the gozar al demai shel ame haaretz, produce purchased from those who were not diligent, you need to tithe the meiser rishon from the outset because maybe he, the Amoraites, didn't tithe it at all. So as we said, we have two stages of rulings. One ruling involved the chaverim, people who were diligent, they had their own fields, and they would tithe the produce from their own fields. The only problem there is that they didn't give their meiser rishon to the Torah-ordained receiver, but rather gave it to the kohanim in accordance with the Knas of Ezra. Therefore, they could not recite the Vidu Meisris. And as far as the reference made to those who weren't tithing at all, yes, that's a reference to Amoratsim, who did not tithe at all. A significant part of the population, not necessarily the majority, but many did not tithe. And regarding that situation, the ruling was, whatever you buy from an Amoritz, you must tithe. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access Marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.